You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. We'd like to say thank you to all American military veterans, past and present. Here's the continuation of Patriot Act by Mae Jong. The island of Palm Beach, 16 miles long and less than a mile wide, remains among the most economically and socially segregated towns in America. Apart from the occasional titled European, many Palm Beach residents have been heirs to various fortunes. The Singer sewing machine, the Watson computer, Jell-O, Listerine. 97% of residents are white, and the median age is 67. Houses come with living rooms that can hold parties of 175, and two pools, one to catch the sun in the morning, the other to catch it in the late afternoon. Rembrandts hang in guest bathrooms. Breakers Row, home to mostly Jewish residents, including Robert Kraft, is referred to by the island's WASP as the Gaza Strip. The clubs are so exclusive, local legend has it, that Burt Reynolds was once turned away at the door on account of his dark skin color. Even Joseph Kennedy Sr. was reportedly spurned on account of his Catholic faith. Besides, his money was deemed too new. It's new if it was made in the past century, explained Debbie Murray, chief curator of the Historical Society of Palm Beach County. Some residents, when I asked them about Kraft, appeared puzzled that a man of such immense wealth would feel the need to leave his valeted residence for a massage, let alone sexual services. What horrified these residents most was that Kraft had gone over the bridge. Over the bridge is West Palm Beach, a service town on the mainland where the support staffs live, maids, gardeners, doctors, judges, anyone who has to work for a living. It is where you go when you can't send someone else, when you have to show up in person at the hospital or the courthouse or the charity photo opportunity. The Publix supermarket on Palm Beach Island sells Marcona almonds. The Publix in West Palm Beach only stocks the standard California variety. Men like Kraft, after all, can have the help come to them. Janine, who used to work on the island as a high-end escort, told me about the many famous Johns she had worked for, a list that includes best-selling authors and rock stars and titans of industry. As a professional, Janine charged $1,000 an hour, about 13 times more than Orchid's. But the high price did not always ensure discretion. There had been one incident, Janine shared, when she took too much cocaine on the job and ended up locking herself and her crack pipe in the bathroom. The client's daughter, desperate to get rid of her, had called the police for help. Two officers managed to restrain Janine, but not before using a taser and a chokehold. Jeff Green, a Palm Beach resident who ranks 232nd on the Forbes list of richest Americans, told me that he could not understand why any man would want to pay for sex, but that he did understand why Kraft had chosen to go across the bridge. Everyone in Palm Beach attends the same parties, Green explained, and wakes up the next morning to read about the self-same parties in the town newspaper, printed on glossy paper so as not to smudge the gloved hands of its readers. Palm Beach is a small town, Green said. I imagine if you want to do something you shouldn't be doing, you go out of town. Luxury items, champagne, caviar, truffles, have no inherent value. They are made desirable through scarcity. But for the tiny stratum of society for whom nothing is unattainable, the commonplace, paradoxically, can attain a luster of its own. If calling up an escort like Janine is akin to ordering Wagyu Beach from room service, then visiting orchids is like swinging by the McDonald's drive-thru. Sometimes you just want a burger. Next photos, strip mall service. After Florida police raided Orchids of Asia Day Spa, co-owner Hua Zhang was charged with procuring prostitution. Zhang started as an esthetician in China. 4. The men. Whenever I encountered men of Palm Beach in their natural habitat, in hotel lobbies, inlet tiki bars, and private clubs, they were exceedingly eager to share stories of their visits to spas like Orchids. In Midtown Manhattan, at a smoke-filled club frequented by seasonal residents like Rudy Giuliani, I fell into conversation about craft with a man at its mahogany bar. I explained that after many months of working on this story for Vanity Fair, I still could not figure out why craft had acted with such abandon. The man, who identified himself as the son of a famous politician, explained that men go to massage parlors for many reasons. In fact, he told me, he was heading to one himself in a few days. If I liked, I would be welcome to accompany him as his guest. The trip did not take place. At a bar in Jupiter, a Patriots fan named Billy told me that he is a regular at Orchids and had visited the spa only 2 weeks before the raid. His father and uncle had served in World War II, he explained, at a time when the U.S. military tacitly endorsed prostitution as good for morale. Over the years, many soldiers returned from Japan and Korea and Vietnam with a highly sexualized view of the women they met. "Marry an Asian woman," Billy recalled being told, "you'll be happy for the rest of your life. Asian women know how to take care of a man. You come home and she cooks dinner, takes your shoes off, never complains." Billy was 42 when he was first taken to a Jack Shack on his way to a Patriots game in New England. After moving to South Florida, friends he made at a local bar told him about Orchids. "A lot of my friends think Asian women are very attractive," Billy said. "That's what I think myself. The girls are beautiful. They are thin, in shape. That's why American guys like that." Indeed, on one of my first nights on the island, I was sitting at a hotel bar, working up the courage to crash a reception for alumni of the Harvard Business School, Kraft's alma mater, that had already begun out on the deck. An older gentleman approached me and asked where the function was. I pointed to the deck. He told me he couldn't hear what I was saying. I suggested he try the deck. He became upset and walked away. Later, the man approached me again, this time to apologize for having behaved rudely. By way of explanation, he told me that he had thought I was a member of the hotel service staff. I introduced myself as a reporter in town on a story, and we began chatting about craft and Jupiter. Suddenly, he leaned toward me, this older man who only moments earlier had treated me with disdain, and began making sexually explicit comments. "I had all these fantasies about you," he confessed. On the island, there were only two preordained roles for a young woman of Asian descent. Being a reporter was not one of them. Next photos, country club life. The Breakers, the Palm Beach resort where Kraft has an apartment. In 2017, Kraft joined President Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at Mar-a-Lago. 5. The Madam. Lulu, the co-owner of Orchids, who allegedly attended to Kraft, lives a world away from her clients. From Palm Beach, you drive through West Palm Beach, past the South Dixie Highway, past laundromats advertising weekday deals and pawn shops after your gold. If you hang a right and drive north until the turnpike narrows, past billboards advertising plastic surgery and personal injury lawyers, past state prisoners performing hot, humid labor, you enter Martin and Port St. Lucie and Indian River counties, where the rest of Florida lives. There, upstream from the source, the story of Kraft and the massage parlor raids has grown muddied. Flora Vera and Sean Williams, who live next door to Lulu, told me they had heard the sex workers had been kept naked so they wouldn't run away. Another neighbor chimed in, telling me it was all part of a complex global conspiracy involving President Trump, full of Byzantine connections that I found impossible to follow. Flora laughed. "Next thing you know, we are saying I saw a UFO," she said. "Well, I did see a UFO," her husband said. He told me that it had appeared above a Kmart parking lot at dusk, hovering above the pines, on his way to church. He had been 12 years old. Later, Flora told me that she has precognitive dreams. Lulu, who had been arrested at home and released after posting a cash bail of $75,000, declined my request for an interview. She has pleaded not guilty to all charges, including soliciting others to commit prostitution. But her business partner, Hua Zheng, who owns the other half of Orchids, agreed to speak to me. Zheng was born into a not rich but respected family in Guangzhou, China, in 1960. After marrying and giving birth to a son, Zheng applied for a U.S. visa in 2001. 5 years later, the visa came through. Zheng hesitated. She was making a good living in China as an esthetician. She knew every bend of every road in Guangzhou. The new country would be full of unfamiliar roads and strangers who wouldn't know how to pronounce her name. But Zheng was a mother before she was anything else, and she decided to immigrate for her son. After the family moved to Los Angeles, Zheng learned there weren't many opportunities for a middle-aged woman with no professional expertise. A friend Zheng made from her English as a second language class suggested she go to work at a massage school run by Jet Li's personal masseuse. At the school, Zheng made another friend, who later moved to Florida to work at a massage parlor there. The friend soon began calling Zheng, pleading with her to join her. Zheng was reluctant, but by that time her son was grown, and she and her husband were filing for divorce. Florida is the land of second acts, and in 2010, Zheng moved to Jupiter to begin her life anew as Mandy. Mandy packed light. She knew everything would be provided. Businesses owned by Chinese Americans, laundromats, restaurants, massage parlors, frequently provide room, board, and transportation for newly arrived workers, who often lack the means and connections to buy or rent a place on their own. After a few years of hard work, Mandy raised enough money to buy Orchids in 2013. She hired workers from Chinese immigrant communities across the country, placing ads in Chinese language newspapers. Mandy also provided daycare for children while their mothers were at work. By then, her son had moved to Florida, and word got out that a Chinese woman and her English-speaking son would take in your kids for a reasonable fee. Soon, Mandy was looking after as many as 11 children. In 2017, Mandy signed over half of the spa to Lulu, one of her steadiest workers. She began devoting most of her time to her grandson, Michael, named after local resident Michael Jordan, who owns a 28,000-square-foot mansion on 3 acres in Jupiter. On the morning of February 19th, Mandy was making coffee at a condominium near the spa that she had rented to house her workers. Suddenly, there was banging at the door. 6 police officers swarmed in, handcuffed Mandy, and booked her in the Palm Beach jail. At the time, I thought, they must have made a mistake, she says. It's so funny. They treat me as a treacherous criminal. I can't believe what kind of system it is. Why do you make such a big move against a family woman? As the co-owner of Orchids, Mandy was charged with a second-degree misdemeanor for maintaining a house of prostitution. She was also charged with 26 counts of soliciting others to commit prostitution, as well as a second-degree felony for deriving support from prostitution, a crime punishable by up to 15 years in prison. She has pleaded not guilty to the charges. A police affidavit lists the victim of her crime as the state of Florida. Because it's our society as a whole that has been victimized by this prurient behavior, explains Robert Norvell, a West Palm Beach attorney who represents one of the defendants in the case. I shit you not. After a few weeks, Mandy was released on bail, unable to return to the condo where 2 of her employees were being detained. She was placed under house arrest in a home that a cousin of hers had put on the market. The house, on a quiet street in a gated subdivision, had not been lived in for some time and was infested with vermin. Mandy spent 6 weeks scrubbing its floors. Her ankle monitor prevented her from taking out the trash or picking the ripe mangoes in the backyard. So she stared at the falling fruit from the window. 6. The mogul. The men who were arrested for availing themselves of Mandy's services faced no such restrictions. After his arrest, Kraft was free to live his best life. He reportedly donated $100,000 at a charity dinner at the Breakers in Palm Beach, attended the annual pre-Oscar brunch at the Beverly Hills home of Barry Diller and Diane von Furstenberg, and watched Rafael Nadal defeat Dominic Thiem in Paris to win the French Open. Kraft was born in 1941 in the affluent Boston suburb of Brookline. In 1963, he married Myra Hyatt, an heiress to a paper box fortune whom he met at a Boston deli. They had 4 children. In 1994, he purchased the New England Patriots, growing the team into one of the most valuable franchises in the National Football League. In 2010, Myra, referred to by some as the smartest Kraft, fell ill with ovarian cancer. During the NFL lockout in 2011, Kraft spent his days negotiating with union representatives, then came home each evening to rub Myra's feet. She died later that year, and Kraft's life became a boat you forgot to tie up. The following year, at a party in Los Angeles, at the home of New York Giants co-owner Steve Tisch, Kraft met Ricky Noel Lander, an aspiring actress, 38 years his junior. The two began seeing each other, on, then off, then on again. Kraft reveled in his newfound status as a single rich guy. Owning a winning football team in America gave him access to a world that money alone can't buy. He was seen at the Met Gala and the Grammys and the Vanity Fair Oscar party, and sometimes appeared at events alongside young women who remained uncredited in photos. Kraft hadn't gone to Orchids on that January day because the Florida heat had driven him mad, or because he was in search of anonymity, or because he had served his country in the Far East. Born the year of Pearl Harbor, he was 13 when the Vietnam War began. He went to Orchids in his relatively new status as a single rich guy to get a massage. And it was in his part as a single rich guy that he came to believe he had done nothing wrong. According to his best friend, he thought there had been something between him and Lulu. He thought she liked him. He thought that what had transpired between them had no business being discussed in a courtroom. If you're affluent, rules loosely apply to you, says Norvell, the lawyer representing one of the defendants. You wear it like a loose garment. As the owner of a 6-time Super Bowl championship team, Kraft understood that sometimes the best defense is a good offense. To represent him in court, he hired William Burke, who withheld sensitive documents from Congress during Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing. Alex Spiro, who defended former Patriots tight end Alex Hernandez after he was charged with murder. And Jack Goldberger, the Palm Beach attorney who helped broker a plea deal for Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein himself, in his twisted worldview, saw Kraft as a kindred spirit. A few months after Kraft was charged, a Fox Business reporter asked Palm Beach's most notorious sex offender if he knew that the girls he had lured to his mansion for massages and sex were underage. Epstein insisted that his own crimes weren't that much different than what happened to Bob Kraft. Only he went somewhere, and they came to me. Kraft's legal team bombarded the court with motions, pushing to bar the public release of the surveillance video from Orchids as an invasion of their client's privacy. It's basically pornography, Burke told the court. On March 28th, the state attorney's office in Palm Beach offered Kraft a plea bargain. If he admitted his guilt, the charges would be dropped and his record expunged. Prosecutors extended the same offer to the other defendants in Palm Beach, a county that, despite being the home of Mar-a-Lago, votes blue. Next door, in the Trump-supporting Martin County, no plea deals were forthcoming. Kraft rejected the plea deal. America's criminal justice system relies on defendants taking plea deals. More than 90% do so. The system was not built to indict rich men, and so it was not prepared for a rich man to reject an offer of leniency. The case would have gone away quickly had Kraft not decided to devote his tremendous resources to destroying the state's case. 7. The rescue industry. Florida, perhaps more than any other state, has been a leader of the Christian rights campaign to rescue those they consider victims of a globally syndicated criminal human trafficking ring. The first comprehensive human trafficking act passed in 2000, but it wasn't until 3 years later when President George W. Bush pledged $50 million to support anti-trafficking organizations that the campaign became a full-fledged industry. Human trafficking is a serious problem. The Department of Health and Human Services calls it the world's fastest-growing criminal industry. But some anti-trafficking groups, in search of funding, routinely overstate the scale of the commercial sex trade. They frequently claim that 300,000 minors are at risk for being sold into sexual slavery in America each year, a number that has been debunked by researchers as wildly overinflated. The Washington Post dismisses it as a nonsense statistic. In 2018, the FBI confirmed a total of 649 trafficking cases in America, adults included. Even more alarming, the exaggerated numbers about sex trafficking have come to inform public policy. On May 3rd, driven in part by spurious statistics, the Florida legislature passed a sweeping new law to combat prostitution. The measure creates a statewide anti-prostitution registry that is intended to list men like Robert Kraft, should he be convicted as a John. But critics worry that the registry, which is vaguely defined, will also wind up including sex workers like Lulu and Shen Mingbi. In doing so, the anti-prostitution law could effectively end up functioning as an anti-immigration law, targeting poor women of color, many of them from Asia. Florida's new sex registry is the latest in a long line of similar laws. One of America's first laws against prostitution, in fact, was the 1870 Act to prevent the kidnapping and importing of Mongolian, Chinese, and Japanese females for criminal or demoralizing purposes, intended to protect the public from scandal and injury. The law was a precursor to the Page Act of 1875, which aimed to end the danger of cheap Chinese labor and immoral Chinese women, which in turn was a precursor to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the first law to bar all members of a specific ethnicity or nationality from immigrating. The raids on orchids and other massage parlors in South Florida were conducted in the name of rescuing women from sex trafficking, but the only people put in jail were the women themselves. A few, like Lulu and Mandy, managed to post bail and were placed under house arrest, but others were transferred to the custody of ICE. Women who migrated to America in search of work, who chose the least bad option available to them, were being punished for what one of their lawyers calls the crime of poverty. The New York Times and other news outlets, quoting investigators, initially presented the raids as a clear-cut case of sex trafficking. Women at the spas, the media reported, were working 14-hour days and sleeping on massage tables. After surrendering their passports to spa owners, they were not allowed to leave the premises without an escort. The wretched women in strip mall brothels were not sex workers, but rather trafficking victims trapped among South Florida's rich and famous. But as police subjected the women to hours-long interrogations, those claims began to unravel. The only woman alleged to have been locked up and forced to live on the premises was Yang Wang, who went by the spa name Nancy. In fact, like many other employees, Nancy had been hired from out of state, so her boss drove her back and forth from the job. When the owner fell ill, Nancy was asked if she wouldn't mind sleeping at the spa. The one woman whose passport had allegedly been taken away was Lisha Zhu, or Yo-Yo. During questioning, the police repeatedly grilled Yo-Yo, looking for evidence of human trafficking. Did anyone else set up her bank account for her? Did anyone else have access to her account? Did you feel like you had a choice to come down and work? Or did you feel like you were forced to? No one forced me, Yo-Yo insisted. It was the terrible winter of 2018, back in Pennsylvania, where she was living at the time, that inspired her to move to Florida. The interrogator pressed harder. Did you feel like you had to do this? Yo-Yo shook her head. Then why did you do it? The inquiry continued along these lines for several more hours. It was somehow easier for law enforcement officers in South Florida to believe that the women had been sold into sex slavery by a global crime syndicate than to acknowledge that immigrant women of precarious status, hemmed in by circumstance, might choose sex work. In the end, Yo-Yo told police that her boyfriend had confiscated her passport, locked it in a safe, and threatened her with a gun. He was the one, she intimated, who had forced her into sexual slavery. Later, during a hearing conducted after she had managed to retain a lawyer, Yo-Yo recanted the story about her boyfriend. She told the police that she had said what she felt the police wanted to hear, in the hopes of getting a lighter sentence. Within weeks of the raids, the state's case had evaporated. There was no $20 million trafficking ring, no women tricked into sex slavery. The things the state had mistaken as markers for human trafficking, long working hours, shared eating and living arrangements, suspicion of outside authorities, ties to New York and China, were, in fact, common organizing principles of many Chinese immigrant communities. As an assistant state attorney in Palm Beach told the court on April 12th, there is no human trafficking that arises out of this investigation. 8. The mix-up. Democrats have tried, so far without success, to tie the Orchids scandal to Donald Trump. Kraft, after all, was a close friend of the president. He had attended Trump's wedding to Melania in 2005 and gave $1 million to his inaugural fund. Trump once reportedly tried to set up Ivanka with Tom Brady, hoping to make the Patriots quarterback his son-in-law. Lee Cindy Yang, the former owner of the Orchids Spa, also donated to Trump's campaign and ran a consulting firm that promised Chinese business executives access to Trump and Mar-a-Lago. On March 15th, congressional Democrats on the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees asked the FBI, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Secret Service to open an investigation into Yang and her alleged ties to Trump. I emailed Nancy Pelosi's office to ask why she wanted Yang to be investigated by a top intelligence agency. The Speaker's press officer, Ashley Etienne, pointed me to news reports about Yang bypassing security at Mar-a-Lago. This was before it broke that she's a likely spy, Etienne added. Etienne appeared to have misidentified Yang. I asked her if she was referring to a separate probe involving a Chinese woman named Yujing Zhang, who had allegedly breached Mar-a-Lago security. I am not sure what you mean, Etienne wrote back, referring me to the FBI for more details. I also emailed Senator Dianne Feinstein, who had signed the letter requesting an investigation. Her press person also responded by citing the case against Zhang. This is political prosecution with no evidence, Cliff Yee, executive director of the National Committee of Asian American Republicans, told me. It reminds us of our experience in China. It reminds us of how we were scared, how we were oppressed. On September 11th, Zhang was convicted of trespassing and lying to federal agents. The FBI has also opened a public corruption investigation into Yang, focusing on whether she illegally funneled money from China into Trump's re-election campaign. Federal prosecutors sent subpoenas to Mar-a-Lago, demanding that it turn over all records relating to Yang. 9. The double standard. Kraft, aided by the best defense team money can buy, seems likely to beat the charges against him. Last May, a judge threw out the video evidence that had been gathered at Orchids, ruling that the warrant had been seriously flawed. The judge also threw out evidence from Kraft's traffic stop, calling it the fruit of an unlawful search. The state is appealing the ruling. Even if he is found guilty, however, Kraft has little to fear in the way of punishment. In Florida, as in most other states, the purchasing of sex is a misdemeanor. The few first-time Johns who wind up being convicted typically pay a fine and perform no more than 100 hours of community service. The selling of sex, however, is policed far more severely. Sex workers are more likely than John's to face repeated arrest, increasing the odds that they will be charged with a felony and sentenced to prison, and have fewer resources to defend themselves in court. And madams, who profit from the prostitution of others, the charge leveled against Mandy and Lulu, can be convicted of money laundering if the proceeds are deposited in a bank, or used to pay rent, or buy milk. While Kraft's legal team fights to have the charges against him dismissed, one of the alleged sex workers arrested in the raids, Li Chen, remains in ICE custody. Under civil forfeiture proceedings, the state seized her J.P. Morgan Chase account, which held $2,900. Until August 21st, when she was transferred to another immigration facility, Chen was held at the detention center in West Palm Beach, a half mile from a strip club where Stormy Daniels performed, and across from the Trump International Golf Club. Another alleged sex worker, Yaping Ren, was also held for 5 months, waiting to be handed over to ICE before being released in July. Her status remains uncertain. Her attorney told me that he has been unable to determine whether she is going to be deported. The county has only 2 court-certified Mandarin interpreters who charge $400 an hour, a prohibitively high fee for his clients. Under Florida law, it would appear, happy endings are the exclusive property of men.
Thank you.
C major. Cynthia Erivo stunned Broadway in The Color Purple, but it's a star turn as Harriet Tubman. Johann Desta writes, that's helped her truly find her voice. Photographs by Micaiah Carter, styled by Samira Nasser. Opening photos, Voice of an Angel, Cynthia Erivo, photographed at Glenwood in Cold Spring, New York. And Into the Woods. The Tony, Emmy, and Grammy-winning Erivo will next tackle the big screen, and it's shown here, photographed in a woodland setting. We're 52 minutes into lunch when Cynthia Erivo remembers she has to call someone to sing them happy birthday. I'm the singing friend, she explains, a mildly amusing declaration because, well, have you heard Erivo's voice? It's a soft, clear soprano that can stretch until it's 100 feet tall, even though it belongs to a 5-foot-1-inch woman whose own friends occasionally mistake her for a child. It is as if silk had a sound. Erivo, 32, formally honed her gift at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. After graduating, she landed a starring role in the London production of The Color Purple in 2013. She stuck with the production for its Broadway revival, collecting a Tony, Emmy, and Grammy along the way. In other words, unless Erivo is only friends with Beyoncé clones, there's no way she couldn't be the singing friend. I'm careful about how I use it. My voice has given me so much over the years, she continues, speaking a hair above a whisper, but not actually whispering, because that can harm the larynx, and Erivo would never do that. Erivo's career has come to a boil in recent years. After landing supporting work in the noir Bad Times at the El Royale and opposite Viola Davis in Steve McQueen's Widows, she's moved into lead roles in the upcoming HBO series The Outsider and a sweeping Harriet Tubman biopic, Harriet. If you were to play Find the Breakout Movie Star among this Brooklyn vegan restaurant's lunch crowd, you'd land on Erivo in about a second. She's wearing a black denim mini dress with a long-sleeve white shirt tied in front. A black Baker Boy hat caps her snow-blonde hair. The look is generously speckled with color. Chunky orange Nikes, acid green glasses, bright blue nails. Taken together, the ensemble doesn't scream, "Look at me," so much as it posits a matter-of-fact question. Why would you look anywhere else? Then there are the 20 ear piercing and a floral tattoo on her thigh, one of dozens covering her midsection. I like the mystery of it, she says sotto voce. I like that nobody knows it's there except me. Erivo grew up in London in a proud Nigerian household where Igbo and Pidgin bounced off the walls. Her father was just barely in the picture until he disowned Erivo when she was 16. Her mother and younger sister, who are both in the health field, have always been supportive of her creative career. Her mother knew her Cynthia would be a performer, because as a child, she hummed as she ate. Erivo's Hollywood climb was precipitated by The Color Purple. McQueen was a fan. Harriet producers Gregory Allen Howard, who also co-wrote the script, and Deborah Martin Chase scouted Erivo during her run as Celie on Broadway. Harriet is the first major biopic to be released in theaters about the abolitionist who freed hundreds of enslaved people, led an armed regiment in the Civil War, and fought for women's suffrage. As such, the film is burdened with so many expectations that even Erivo's casting received backlash. Detractors wondered why a Brit should play an African-American icon. Some skeptics have even gone so far as to call Erivo's casting disrespectful. Erivo, who grew up admiring Tubman, can understand the criticism. I can't say that I'm not surprised, even if she didn't quite see it coming. Director and co-writer Casey Lemons had an inkling the casting might cause a stir, but says she saw undeniable upside. I thought, okay, here's a petite woman who's very strong, who can sing, who's West African. I found a lot of similarities, Lemons says. Erivo researched Tubman's life and employed a dialect coach. Lemons loaded her up with material, determined to create a portrait of Tubman that included both her heroic deeds and her less-known personal life. The rough cut of the film I saw this summer included sequences depicting Tubman's parents, her doomed marriage, and the head wound that gave her seizures, sleeping spells, and religious visions. In Erivo's hands, Tubman is humble but steely, a quick and quiet speaker who rises as a determined, formidable leader. The experience has made Erivo an ardent Tubman fan and scholar. Between bites of her pho bowl and soy nuggets, she swipes open her phone to show me Tubman-inspired signet rings and pendants she just purchased from Brooklyn jewelry designer Suet Siam. They're thick and gold, depicting Tubman surrounded by swirling stars and moons. It's not lost on Erivo that Tubman's legacy, with its moral clarity and literal heroics, makes her a ready subject for such 21st century iconography and, regrettably, our current culture wars. Tubman's portrait was to appear on a $20 bill redesign announced by the Obama administration. Trump Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin delayed it 6 years, citing technical difficulties. "It annoys the hell out of me," Erivo said. "I don't understand how he can do that." Erivo is generally frustrated by the current political climate. She tries, when she can, to shut Trump out of her mind. What he's doing is not remotely new at all. It's just loud. She is even more critical of Britain's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. "He's just so unintelligent," she says. For the most part, though, Erivo is optimistic and ebullient, willing to engage on any topic. When asked about her love life, she again produces her phone to show off photos she took with her boyfriend, Mario Martinez. "He chased me," she says. "He's not in the industry, but he's adjacent enough that they saw each other often. Whenever they did, he would ask her out, even though she was dating someone, her ex, the actor Dean John Wilson. Then, the last time, I was not with my ex anymore. Except this time, he did not ask," Erivo recalls. "He just walked up to me and gave me a kiss. They've been together for 2 years." She's open about her life and forthright about her career goals. She's got an album on the way. It's her dream to play Serena Williams in a biopic one day. When she mentions career idols, she goes straight for the juggernauts, Barbara Streisand and Whitney Houston. But it took time to build that resolve. Erivo wouldn't change going to RADA, but she says that there were times it was frustrating to be one of a handful of black students at a school that felt ill-equipped to handle people of color. When she was cast in a small role in One Big Musical, for instance, one of the leads lost her voice. Erivo was asked to go behind the curtain, singing in the rain style, and perform so the other actor could lip-sync. "To this day, I'm still like, why did I do that?" she says. "It still feels a bit yuck, to be honest. To think about loaning out her voice, considering how far it's taken her." their tube. YouTube has helped to fundamentally remake the way we think about fame, clout, and the very idea of entertainment. As it prepares to turn 15, Richard Lawson surveys a generation of creators, discovering their cultural power and, sometimes, their limits. Photographs by Ethan James Green. Emma Chamberlain, age 18, genre, lifestyle, and comedy. First post, June 2017. Subscribers, 8.43 million. It's like you're doing 10 people's jobs at once, says Chamberlain of the YouTuber grind, filming, editing, and of course being the on-air personality. It's a crazy amount of work. And yet, Chamberlain always seems to be having fun, even when tired or stressed or dealing with the latest zit. That energy has proven infectious. Chamberlain's rise on the platform has been meteoric, though hopefully with less flaming out than that term suggests. There are multiple stages of burnout for sure, Chamberlain says. I'm surprisingly not in one right now. I'm actually kind of enjoying the process right now, which is amazing and rare for creators. Emma Chamberlain is 18 years old and grew up watching YouTube videos. Over the past 2 years, she has entered the fray herself, becoming one of the most dynamic contributors to Google's video hosting behemoth, posting prosaic videos documenting her misadventures as a nascently independent adolescent. She vlogs trips to Coachella and fashion halls and tours of Los Angeles's many coffee shops. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.